Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Every Sunday morning at 9, join me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM. Each week we'll be exploring the wonderful world of modern jazz. From hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz, Sunday mornings at 9 on Sheffield Live.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every week. You've got Julian Paul here live as usual. We've got Chris yes. Dale in the studio with us. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, team.
Thank you for joining us. A bit of a different science show this week. You can listen, of course, I should have said, on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, but you can also listen on digital, but sheffieldlive.org, you can download the podcast there, pop up about 12:30, all being well. If you click on the podcast, it'll download, but click on three dots to the side and save it to your system. It's a lot easier to listen that way, and you'll be able to keep the podcast forever, should you want to share it and listen again in the future. So, a bit of a different science show this week, because if you're a regular listener, you'll know we have guest speakers, of which Chris Dale is one. He generally comes to talk about ultra-processed food, the impact of that on our health. But this week we've got Tom Wenham, Great Britain lacrosse coach, heading towards the Olympics 2028 in Los Angeles. And if you are a regular listener, you'll remember in July this year we had George Dale from Nottingham University as our guest speaker, and he explained what sports science is and the key elements of sports science. So as I said, today we've got Tom Wenham, who is Great Britain lacrosse head coach, on the phone, and he's here to talk about his lacrosse journey, but mainly to talk about how sports science is used in preparing an elite team ready to compete at a world level. Tom is also a European Championship gold medal winner and has represented England as a player and a coach in the lacrosse World Cup. So a very big welcome to Tom. Good morning, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning, Julie. Thanks very much for having me on.
Oh, thank you for joining us. And I believe you're up in Ilkley.
I am indeed, a snowy eel clay.
A snowy eel clay. Thanks for joining us this morning. As I said, we've got Chris here. And many thanks to Chris, actually, for organising this interview for us. We've known Chris for a long time. I believe you have too. So my first question, Tom, is how do you know Chris?
I know Chris very well. Chris has played a very significant role, whether he knows it or not, in my lacrosse journey. Certainly my journey as a coach. Chris was assistant manager of the England national team back in the day. We're talking a while ago now. And when I was a player, so my first experience of playing for England in a major competition was the European Championships, Stockholm, in 1997. And Chris was the assistant manager of that team. And I would say that is still, despite having done a heck of a lot of things since, that's a while ago now, isn't it? But despite plenty of time passing under the bridge, I would say that is still one of my most positive lacrosse experiences. So really, really grateful to Chris kind of starting my journey as an international player, and then I guess ultimately then as an international coach on such a positive footing.
Wow, fantastic. I'm going to pass you over to Chris now, because obviously he's more experienced in lacrosse than I am.
Hiya, Tom. Chris. Kind words. Well, Stockholm 1997 was a really good tour. We had a really good touring team, didn't we? Good fun.
We did. Yeah, good fun. And I think that is important, isn't it, Chris? We're going to talk about sports science and kind of that elite end of high performance environments and how you get all of those. What Brailsford would have coined as marginal gains and that little extra 1% here and there, and perhaps sports science can give you some of that. But you're absolutely right. Fun, enjoyment. Remember why you do it. Have some element of perspective, and that was definitely one of the most challenging, but one of the most enjoyable experiences of my lacrosse journey. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, and obviously Phil Howarth was part of the management team as well.
Yes.
And yeah. He's now living in America, but of course Phil was very instrumental in getting finance into that era of lacrosse.
Yes.
So that made a big difference to the players. So it meant we could just focus on lacrosse. So.
Yeah, and another good Sheffield connection with the head coach at the time was Paul Coops, who was very much through the Sheffield Steelers lacrosse club at that time. So
did a great Sheffield job. Connection. So Tom. We have a few questions for you. We've got lots of time, so we can just relax and have a nice little chat. But for the benefit of our listeners, Tom, and I have to say we are expecting more listeners than normal this time. Just explain a little bit about the sport of lacrosse and tell us about it becoming an Olympic sport for both men and women.
Yeah, what a fabulous journey for the sport to be on. I think one of the great sort of secrets of the sporting landscape, really, because it's a fascinating history that lacrosse has, and then this current Olympic pathway that we're on hopefully will bring the game to a whole new audience. So the history of the sport is the indigenous people of North America, a game that their cultural history suggests was given to them by the creator. And was given to them as the medicine game, a way of kind of healing rifts between tribes, between communities, and then at the time there's kind of this, we're talking, I mean, maybe as early as like the 1700s. So this is a sport with a real long history in North America. Stories of it being used as a means of settling disputes, of training young men for war. So a very symbolic and significant cultural history. The rules are then codified by missionaries, and that's where the name comes from, lacrosse, the missionaries feeling that the stick that the athletes used at the time looked like a bishop's crozier. That's the sort of the story of the game. So it's then codified and turned into a more, I guess, recognised sport with rules and some more structure to it.
And it was George Beers, who was a French dentist, that actually did the first lot of rules, and that's why partly my son is called George, named after George Beers. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Do you know?
Yeah, well, you'll know as well as that. But then you'll remember, Chris. It's that then created the tennis side game that I think most people who know lacrosse will know now. You know, international lacrosse certainly is either played indoors in what's known as a box lacrosse format, and that's played on converted ice hockey rinks. It's the one of the national sports of Canada, along with ice hockey, and very, very high profile sport in North America. And then the tennis side version, more often played outdoors and internationally, 23-man squads. And that has a long history, both in the UK and more widely now, getting real global traction as a format. But the journey for the Olympics, pretty clear that tennis side sport was not going to be considered by the IOC. There's a hard cap on the number of athletes at Olympic Games now, and the tennis side game is rolling subs. So you have 10 on the field, but you have 13 substitutes. So the game is described as the fastest game on 2 feet. Lots of subs on and off, rolling substitutions. That's not going to work from an Olympic point of view. So not that long ago, I think we're only kind of really talking about 5 years ago, World Lacrosse were looking at a format that the IOC might be more interested in. And we're looking around at other sports and other models that had worked, and rugby sevens had been successful of getting that format into the Olympic Games as a small-sided version. And they wanted a game that was commercially viable, or a format of the game that was commercially viable, that would appeal to spectators, could be picked up by new countries internationally, might bring a new audience and a new kind of grassroots performance to the sport. And so they came up with sixes, and sixes is very, very new, and it's that version that will be in the Olympic Games.
Oh, it's a fantastic journey, and I think the lacrosse world is very excited, and I suspect you being head coach, you're doubly excited too.
Indescribably so, Chris, and for all sorts of reasons. I come from the field lacrosse, you know, the tennis side background. That is my background and the version that I played. But I think that six-a-side offers so much, not just from the elite side, which obviously we're going to talk about, but also from the participation side. How can we get more people excited about lacrosse? How can we get more people playing lacrosse? And I think the six-a-side version is a great vehicle for us to do that.
You mentioned, just before I move on away from this, you did mention about the indigenous people, the Haudenosaunee. Now, the Haudenosaunee actually compete in lacrosse as their own nation, don't they?
They do, and at a very, very high level. Yes, it's always something special. I think to play them. There's a sort of a crossover between maybe the All Blacks and rugby, that the sport obviously has such enormous significance to them, and to see them enter the field of play and the blessing that they do on the pitch before games and so on. Yeah, always very special to play them.
And will the Haudenosaunee be playing in the Olympic Games in 2028?
To be decided, I think. They are not currently recognised by the IOC. As a lacrosse person, it obviously is, as I say, is incredibly special to have them involved in the sport, and they've given us the sport, so an enormous amount to be grateful for, as much as anything. But I think that politically, there's probably some work to be done about that IOC recognition and them being a sovereign nation and having an Olympic committee who can represent them. So
it is just such an honour to play against them, isn't it? It just makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you play the Haudenosaunee. Fantastic players.
Yeah.
So Tom,
yeah, agreed.
So you've had, let's be honest, a pretty good lacrosse journey so far, haven't you? I just wondered if you could just briefly talk through your sort of journey from being a lacrosse player through to England. And then England lacrosse coach, of course, because you've represented England at a World Cup, and also now the Great Britain coach. But Julie wanted to ask you.
Oh, I did, Tom. If you've never played lacrosse or seen lacrosse, or maybe not even heard about lacrosse. How would you describe it to somebody who's never seen it?
Great, great question. So, two goals at either end of the pitch, a full-size pitch, roughly the same size as a football pitch, but the goals themselves are 6 foot by 6 foot. The goals are inside the boundaries of the pitch. So think ice hockey. You can go behind the goal. You can play behind the goal. There's some kind of complex offside rules, which, you know, a little bit like football, isn't it? Everyone's kind of constantly trying to work out the offside rules. But there's certainly some offside rules. But fundamentally, of those 10 players, you'd have three. You'd have one goalkeeper and you'd have three defenders, three midfielders and three attackers. And the aim of the game is to throw a solid rubber ball into the 6 foot by 6 foot goal. In terms of rules, think ice hockey in terms of its physicality and its aggression. So if you've got the ball in your stick, and I'm describing primarily men's lacrosse here, women's lacrosse slightly different, but men's lacrosse you can take the ball out of the stick by hitting the stick, by hitting the gloves. You can take out. You can certainly run with the ball. And then the six-a-side version is a kind of condensed version of that. It's a slightly smaller pitch. It's obviously only six players on the pitch. There's no complicated offside rules. Everybody can go everywhere. And I think the most notable feature, Julie, is its speed. It is incredibly fast. It is constantly up and down. The six-a-side version of the game has got a shot clock like basketball. So in terms of its tactics and its gameplay, I think we'd probably see quite a lot of crossover with basketball, and you'd certainly see that up and down, that transition nature to it, that kind of speed from one end to the other. It's why I described it before as kind of this great kept secret. It's incredible. I'm biased, but
it's an incredible game. It makes lacrosse so exciting now.
Yes, and lots of goals. I mean, we're in the six-a-side version. I think it's probably be increasingly unusual not to see a team score 20 goals a game. So it's kind of constant up and down action, four quarters of 8 minutes, and players just kind of to the maximum of their physical capability more often than not. So very, very exciting to watch.
Okay, so just to draw you back to my original question, I apologies for throwing that in. So just tell us about your lacrosse journey, sort of from player to England to England coach to Great Britain coach.
Yes, well, I can't claim any sort of family ties or great historical love or even knowledge of the game. I went to a school where everybody played rugby, or certainly all the boys played rugby. And my introduction was lacrosse was simply to get out of rugby. So this is secondary school.
Very sensible.
I was quite tall, quite young, and they stuck me in the second row, and you know, that just was not a natural home for me and not something I wanted to do. And the only other choices at my school, I remember the head of PE was a Welshman, and if you didn't play rugby, there was something slightly wrong with you in his eyes, I think. So he was passionate about his rugby, but your only other alternatives were field hockey, or there was a maths teacher who ran a lacrosse team. This is in South Manchester, kind of 80s.
Is that Vaughan Wilcox?
Vaughan Wilcox, yeah.
He taught me.
No longer with us, sadly, but amazing man. So I played lacrosse at school, simply to get out of rugby. And then I think, if I'm being completely honest, it's easier to be a bigger fish in such a small pond. You know, obviously there's not that many people playing lacrosse, very much a minority sport. So I was able, by the time I left school, to be, certainly having played Cheshire under 16s, under 19s, I was knocking on the door of England under 19s. And then I went to what at the time was the most successful university team. And the reason that they had such a high profile, this is Sheffield University, is that they played in the league. They were the only university that had a team that was playing in the top division, first division, then Premier Division now. And so I went to Sheffield University simply to play lacrosse. And by the time I left there, I was probably on the edge of the England national team then, and certainly played England universities and some other representative versions of the game. And after university, I was part of the England team from about 1996 to 2002. So like you say, Chris, European Championships. I started with Stockholm, and then we had Manchester in 1999, and I played in the World Championships in Australia in 2002. And my route into coaching was that I retired as a player, certainly retired internationally, and the head coach of England at the time asked me if I wanted to come and help out with the defence. That was my position. It felt like a natural fit. My coaching at the time was, I think, incredibly ill-informed, if I'm honest. I simply knew what I'd liked as a player and what I didn't like as a player. I don't think I was basing my coaching on any particular philosophy or methodology, which I think has undoubtedly changed over time. But I just started coaching the England team and was assistant coach working with the defence, and then head coach from 2016 for the European Championships, 2018 for the World Championships, and when the opportunity came up to coach GB, which is a kind of a fresh opportunity for us in lacrosse. Lacrosse is very much England, Wales and Scotland, but the GB team was set up, one, because of this new sixes, the format that at the time we were hoping would get into the Olympics. It hadn't yet been confirmed at that point. But it was it also GB because of obviously IOC rules, as we compete as Team GB when we're at the Olympic Games rather than England, Wales and Scotland. So the sixes version is what will be played at the Olympics, and I've been head coach of that team since its inception in 2021.
And you've just come back from Germany, haven't you?
Played them over here. They came
Came to us.
Not long back from the USA. They're the probably them and Canada are the two strongest nations. Pleased to say that we're certainly at sixes level. We're the strongest team in Europe. So played Germany three times and I managed to win all three, which was really pleasing with some solid performances.
Well done. Okay, so we've talked about the sixes and everything else. So can you just tell us, could you describe what it takes to be a good lacrosse player, and what attributes do you need to progress to being a top world class lacrosse Olympian?
This from a sports science, from a coaching perspective, I think is a fascinating question. Because in lacrosse, like I say, we've been used to this field version, and this field version has got a very, very long history with lots of coaching knowledge and experience and people making sense of the demands of that format. And then sixes comes along and it's totally new. So it's only since 2020, really, that's been going. The first thing that we did in answer to your question, Chris, is kind of go into it, I think I'd like to say, with a little bit of sort of humility, in that this is a new format. Nobody knows what those attributes are. Nobody's got real clarity of what a good sixes player looks like. And not only do we not know that, we're probably clouded by our preconceptions and our assumptions about what a good tennis-side lacrosse player looks like. So we're kind of trying to break and challenge our own assumptions. So what we did was really really specific to that aim, is we wanted an evidence-based approach. We wanted an evidence-informed approach. So looking at a model that would help us make sense of those attributes, and a four-corner model that would be pretty common to a number of invasion games. So one corner being the skills required, another one being the physical aspects and elements required, another corner being the tactical elements, and then the fourth being a sort of more psychosocial lifestyle element. And to brief overview of each of those, the skills of the game, I think a good lacrosse player, from a skills point of view, has got to be able, particularly sixes, has got to be able to finish the ball. You've got to be able to shoot. And within that, you've got to be able to make good decisions about when to shoot and where to shoot from. And then you need to have the technical ability to the goal's only 6 foot by 6 foot. And Julia, someone who hasn't seen lacrosse, it might surprise you, the player that the ball will, a shot will regularly travel over 120 miles an hour. So the players are generating huge amounts of force. So those skills, those finishing skills, then need some kind of physical attributes to them. And there I'd say you're looking at speed, accelerations and decelerations combined with changes of direction. So you're really looking, Chris, to your question, the attributes. You need a world-class athlete. And I think one of the things around physical play, particularly in sixes, is that there's probably, I was going to say, kind of options for all, in that you probably can be a bigger player, more powerful, and dominate your defender that way. But probably overall, I think that that speed, that agility, that change of direction is going to be really important in sixes. And then from a tactical point of view, you're looking at really good decision makers, players who understand risk and reward. You don't want to be losing possession by trying to be, you know, too risky in your gameplay and you just give the ball back to the opposition. That's no good to us. And then from a psychosocial point of view, the game is so fast, it's so backwards and forwards, that we're looking for players with real and mental and emotional resilience who just flush any errors, indeed flush all the good stuff. You can't let yourself get too high, you can't let yourself get too low. You've just got to move on to the next play in the game. And that combined with as I said before, that understanding of risk and reward, I think those would be some of the key attributes that we would be looking for.
Tom, it sounds like you're describing me as a player, but in my dreams. Anyway.
Calm down, Chris. We do benchmarking with all the players. You're very welcome to join in.
Yeah, Julie asked me earlier. She said, what's the difference about coaching men's lacrosse to coaching women's lacrosse? I just said women generally are more skillful at the game than the men. What would your answer be to Julie, the difference between coaching the men and the women?
Well, first of all, Julie, the equipment and the rules are slightly different. So the stick, so that's what we use to move the ball from player to player to throw the ball around. It's slightly different in the women's, and I think you're right, Chris. That certainly requires a different set of techniques. I don't think it is as easy, perhaps isn't the right word, but there is definitely a different mechanisms at play when you're playing with a women's stick. They have some different rules about contact. They're certainly not as physical as we are. They're not allowed to take out. They're not allowed to hit each other. They don't wear helmets. They don't wear gloves like the men's game would do. But because of that, some of their defensive play is just phenomenal. They have to rely on body position and having their hips underneath them. Yeah, it's very, very skillful game.
Yeah, well, what I wanted to do now is start to move a little bit more into the sports science bit. So the world of sport is getting ever more competitive. So from a sports science perspective, how has that helped you compete at the highest level and also perform as a coach?
Yeah, I think the coach question is definitely relevant. The as a player is a kind of shameful admission. I mean, I was playing 25 years ago, Chris, and I really don't think that I understood enough, embraced this enough. I mean, we went to the gym, we did bleep tests that I'm sure plenty of people will remember.
We did a bit on diet as well. We had Alistair McMichael, sports scientist in 97, and we did a bit on diet, but I mean, we're miles off. We were miles off from where we are today, aren't we? Weren't we?
Completely agree. And from a coaching point of view, I mean, the first thing is a reliance on experts and on expertise. I'm really lucky as a head coach of a national team, of the GB team, that we've got Dr. Nick Ripley, who looks after all of our strength and conditioning. We've got Matt Collier, who looks after the medical side of things, and the work that they do, as I say, being evidence-informed. You know, right from the get-go, we wanted to go out and do some real studies on what are the demands of the sport. So the use of GPS data for every game we play, every training session that we have, the access to injury surveillance information now that we have is definitely not something that I remember from my playing days. And it's almost a kind of a no stone unturned type conversation. Yeah. We were even chatting earlier this week as a coaching group about the new smart mouth guards that are coming out that can register concussion and start to help your knowledge around that. So there's some real real change, I would say. I mean, I know the distance that every player runs in every game. I know how many accelerations and decelerations they have. I know their top speed. I know when they were last injured. I have monitoring reports that suggest how at risk they are of future injury. There's just so much data and so much evidence now that that really wasn't, just wasn't available in my day, or certainly not available within our budgets and without the resources that we had at the time.
It's hard to imagine. In 1991, we went on tour to Syracuse, and myself and Mark Coops was head coach of that England team. We actually had to put the medical pack together because we didn't even have a physiotherapist or a doctor or a nurse at that time. You can't believe it, can you, these days? But anyway, Julie's just, I think we're going to come to a break and we're going to play.
Brilliant. It sounds amazing, Tom. I've learnt so much just from listening to you. Now, before we continue with the rest of the interview, and later on we're going to come and talk to you about sports science and about how the different elements of sports science are applied when you're preparing, particularly for the Olympics. But before that, you've chosen a piece of music, and it's a great piece of music as well. I just want you to tell us what you've chosen and why.
It's Don't Stop Believing by Journey. One of my favourite places to be is on a team coach bus travelling to a game. And this particular tune reminds me of 2008, when I was head coach of the England under-19 team, who were a loud and leery bunch and really, really good fun to be around, and would frequently belt this out at the tops of their voices, some of them more in tune than others, but always entertaining, and very, very fond memories of that team and this song.
Fantastic. Here we go.
Somewhere
favourite track there, Don't Stop Believing by Journey. If you just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also get the podcast, which will be available from about 12:30. Today, all good stuff. We're going to continue the interview with Tom Wenham, who's the Great Britain lacrosse head coach. Go ahead, Chris.
Hiya, Tom. We Julie actually interviewed George Dale from Nottingham University back in July, just talking about sports science in general. And George spoke about psychology, physiology, diet, strength and conditioning, and lifestyle support. So I just wondered, around those topics, if you could give our listeners some practical examples of how you apply these elements of sports science when preparing for the Olympics.
Yeah, happy to. That list, I think what's really probably most significant from our perspective to start with is athlete-centred, so the athlete at the centre, so you're using this evidence and this sports science to best support the athlete, and then a holistic approach. So I think in and of themselves, there isn't probably one thing that stands out above others. It's making sure we have a holistic approach to what we do. So in things like psychology, we would be building into practice design, the decision-making that the players are likely to need in games, helping them to understand risk and reward. When do they try and innovate and be creative? When do they try and do things that are perhaps a little bit more, you know, safer and secure? So that would certainly be in our practice design and the drills that we use. From a physiology point of view, we've done an enormous amount of research, and to the level where that research has then been peer-reviewed, published in academic articles. So we're at talking sort of gold standard, you know, Olympic standard, if you like, of research. And that would be, we've done around GPS data and physical demands of the sixes format. That's been led by Dr. Nick Ripley. Matt Collier has done some amazing research around injury surveillance and the prevalence, the types of injury. And obviously what we're trying to do, and what I'm really keen at, from a coaching point of view, is how do we mitigate that? We want to have our players as fit and fast and powerful as possible, but we also need to have them injury free and available for selection. From a strength and conditioning point of view, so all of the players would be looking at GPS vests like you'd see for any of those kind of Premier League football, or you see them between the shoulders on rugby, don't you? And we use that data increasingly to put together individualized fitness training plans for the program. Every single player would have a personal development plan going forwards, and a lot of that revolved around an understanding of load. So we've just started using a new app and kind of a web system that underpins that app to understand the load of the players. So that's primarily their physical load. Are they overtraining? Are they doing too much? Do they need to do more of a particular type of training? So we've got real accurate data on that. And then probably actually for lacrosse, you might also, that whole holistic thing, you might start to look at physical load or emotional load, social load. These are players who are still full-time careers or full-time education. So having an understanding of their wider lifestyle, as you said, Chris, that's really important. We've just appointed a dedicated member of staff to British Lacrosse, and it will be her role to understand the welfare and provide lifestyle support to the players, and throughout all of it, very much based on research. The idea of, and look, coaches still have opinions, you'll remember that. I definitely do, and I definitely have things that I feel are important, but as much as possible, I want those opinions to be informed by research, by evidence, and by the expertise of people who are absolutely world-leading in their field. And I'm really pleased to say we've got plenty of those people involved in British lacrosse.
It sounds like you've got a fantastic team around you. And as a head coach, sometimes it can be a bit of a lonely position, can't it? So having a good team around you is very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't know everything, and you should accept and respect that's the case. I think my role is to know enough to have meaningful conversations with the experts that we have. So I'd like to think I can talk about biomechanics and nutrition and so on and ask informed questions. But I'm certainly not an expert. I wouldn't have said in any of those specific fields.
Well, couple of supplementaries. The first one that I sort of wanted to mention is that although my sports science experience was quite limited when I was part of the England squad, there were just some players that embraced it, and there were other players it just washed over them, and they just did not get why are we doing sports science, why are we talking psychology. Do you still get that?
I would say a lot less than we used to. I think there's still a cultural shift that we need to see in elite lacrosse. Our game comes from, by definition, very amateur roots, and by the time we get to the Olympics, I think we're probably going to have created a comprehensive shift in attitudes. But actually, on the whole, the GB squad are phenomenally good at that. They've got an understanding of their own diet, their own well-being. I mean, as I said, the holistic approach means that everybody's different, and what works for one person might be less effective for another. So they do spend a lot of time and take a lot of ownership of their own development and their own understanding of sports science and how it can work for them.
You just mentioned biomechanics, and in the studio, we just wanted to just, if you could just maybe explain biomechanics to our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in very, very simple terms, people's movement. To give an example of how we might do that, as I said, finishing, being able to put the ball in the back of the goal, you know, that fundamentally is a really, really important skill. So being able to analyse what cues are the goalkeepers reading, what cues do the goalkeepers look at when somebody shoots? The ball travels at 120 miles an hour. It's like trying to hit a serve in tennis or hit a fastball in cricket. Simply focusing on the ball is not enough. You've got to have some pattern recognition. So one of the studies we want to start doing is to put glasses onto our goalkeepers, which tracks their eyes, which will track where their gaze, you know, their gaze recognition, what they're looking at. And then we can start to see what information they're reading when they're looking at shooters. That helps our goalkeepers, that helps our shooters. And if we can do that in a capture hall where we've got access to cameras who can look at the biomechanics, the movement of shooting, and get some slow motion video where we can really start to break down people's individual styles of shooting the ball, I think that could be something that would give us a competitive advantage.
Yeah, one of the things in all the things that you're saying here, money, because all this stuff. Because I remember in 97 and 98, we managed to raise, or Phil Howarth managed to raise 20,000 in sponsorship, and we sports matched that. So we had sort of 40K over two years and two tours. Which was absolutely fantastic. And that was probably the last time we had that sort of level of funding. So if you could just maybe explain how it's funded, where the money's coming from, and, you know, maybe an appeal to anybody that could help maybe.
Yeah, and I think you're right, Chris. That 1997 was certainly the last time I remember significant amounts of funding coming into the sport. We're funded by player donation. You know, players pay their own way for training, for tournaments, for the vast expense of having access to this kind of sports science and being able to travel for major tournaments. They have to fund that themselves. Now, as an Olympic sport, our hope is that there will be potentially some financial support from UK sport, but also they might be able to give us access to resource in the form of sports science. So that's something that's currently being discussed. But we're desperate to take the burden away from the players, and therefore funding is a real key issue for us. And we've got a genuine medal chance at the Olympics. I mean, in the sixes format, we're currently ranked fourth in the world. We've just played the USA, where we were competitive, and I think they would see themselves as number one or number two. So we're there or thereabouts, and the reality of winning Olympic medals is it's not a cheap business. So we're always very, very keen to talk to commercial partners who might be interested in helping us get to that next level and push from a current ranking of fourth into those medal positions.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Just conscious of time. So this is the big one that I wanted to ask you, because when we did the European Championships in 1997, we played six games in 7 days, I think it was. And you recently in the World Cup, you played seven games in 8 days, I think it was. It's really intensive stuff. These are amateurs, you know, the lacrosse players, you know, that they're professional athletes, as it were, but amateurs. Yeah. How do you keep them focused? How do you keep them injury free? How do you keep them from not getting shin splints and all that sort of stuff during a tournament?
Well, what you're describing, Chris, is experiences of field lacrosse. Sixes lacrosse is even more savage, I would suggest.
Right. Yeah, it looks it.
I think that we'll be playing two games a day. I think that that will be the Olympic format, that they'll, a little bit like rugby sevens, the expectation to play two games in one day over multiple days. So, in answer to your question, well, how do you deal with that? A long, long time before the competition starts. All of the training is building up towards that. It's not only building speed, endurance, agility, acceleration, deceleration. It's building physical resilience. It's building that ability to cope with those demands. The rest and recovery then becomes really important. So diet, nutrition. I think some of the science around ice baths is being questioned. However, there is a very, very strong placebo effect. So I think that therefore there's still relevance for them. And that is something that we would use. There's a phenomenal medical team who would work with players against their individual needs. And that prehabbing as well as rehabbing would be something that's significant for us. And then you mentioned the focus, Chris. It's really, really important.
Yeah.
If you're going to play two games in one day, you have to be able to flush at the end of one game. So the way we do that is we have a hot review. The players just immediately after the game will talk through what went well, what didn't go well, what they want to do differently in the next game. And that kind of draws a line under that previous game. And then we would also rely on data. We would have a whole raft of data about their performances, which would enable them to how they've done. And we can then kind of reset and move on to the next game and, as you say, refocus.
And just a quickie around diet. That's one of the areas that I'm a guest speaker on the Live Science Show talking about diet. So if you could just maybe talk about that, you know, during a tournament.
Yeah, there's a kind of quite a small number of things that if you get them right, the player groups will be happy. So transport and accommodation would be up there. Can they get to games quickly and easily? And are the beds comfy? But then you're absolutely right. Feeding them, and we would focus on that from both a pre-game point of view and then also a post-game. And we're actually in the process of trying to get some value in kind support from a major nutrition company. And I think that that is the next step that we need to move forward with the group. You're absolutely right. The fueling beforehand for that two games in one day, and then that ability to refuel, really important. And then the other thing is hydration. I mean, it's a fairly kind of inexact measure, but we would certainly weigh the players before and after games, particularly in hot climates, and then that would help to inform how much fluid they had to take on board afterwards.
Oh, that's brilliant, Tom. So I'm going to just pass over to Julie now, just to sort of wrap this up. And obviously, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Fantastic,
really,
Tom.
Really grateful,
I'm hoping you might come back. But before that, how well do you think the Great Britain lacrosse team will do in the LA Olympics in 2028? Of course, you may be biased on this.
Well, of course I am. Of course I am. Both the men and the women are ranked fourth at the last major competition that included all of the top teams. I'm very, very confident that both the men and the women will be able to put themselves in a position where medalling is a realistic ambition. But I've got to say, Julie, for both squads, it's very, very much that our current aim is to put together a performance system that gives both squads a chance of winning gold. Now, that's a lofty ambition. That's certainly a challenging ambition. The sport in North America is professional, and you're looking at athletes who've been in effect professional for a large part of their lacrosse careers, where it's a very different model in Great Britain. But that's our aim. We're going to go for an Olympic gold in 2028.
Yeah, I mean, I think Canada's going to be the strongest team in the Olympics. Yeah. I don't know what you think.
I completely agree. I think that they've got the athletes, the tactical offensive play that gives them certainly an advantage in that area. But I don't think that it's an insurmountable gap, Chris. So, I'm confident that we can cause some shocks along the way.
I'm always available, Tom, if you need me.
Brilliant. Before we go on any further, Tom, can I just ask, to be a successful Olympian in terms of lacrosse, how much is physical ability and how much is mental ability? How you deal with it? Is it 50-50? Or is it a different split?
What a great question. I think that at the elite level, all of the international athletes are incredibly fit, incredibly fast. They're all able to accelerate, decelerate, all of that agility stuff that I've talked about. And that actually probably what differentiates the world class from those who are just slightly below is that psychological element, is that decision-making, is that ability to perform under pressure, is that resilience to bounce back from challenges or not to get too carried away with your own successes. And I think that probably, the difference between the best and the very, very best psychological would certainly play a huge part in that.
Amazing. Now, for me, my favourite all-time lacrosse player is, of course, Chris Dale.
Yeah, but that's because I'm the only lacrosse player.
Exactly,
you
but
know.
Now I know Tom Wenham, don't I? So
and George and Tom.
Oh, of course, and I know Tom and George Dale, of course, as well. But may I ask, Tom, who is your favourite lacrosse player, and how has that athlete influenced your lacrosse playing and coaching style?
Yeah, what a really, really interesting question. It's players of my generation that I remember. Players like Mark Millen, Mikey Powell, who I was a defender. They're both more offensive players, and I marked both of them, and they made me look daft for an entire four quarters. So,
Tom, they've made loads of people look daft.
Yes. So sort of bittersweet memories of those two. And you just take a little bit of every player that you work with, Julie, and try to kind of influence your own coaching style and your coaching philosophies against what you feel is going to work most effectively in the moment. But certainly those two would stick out.
Brilliant. So thank you so much for joining us, Tom. We really, really do appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have.
Really have. Absolute pleasure.
Brilliant.
Always a joy to talk lacrosse, and very, very grateful for the opportunity to promote the sport.
And what an honour to have you as well. And well, really well done to Chris as well. He might be after my job. He's looking at me now.
No chance. No.
So we wish you and, of course, the Great Britain lacrosse team all the very best for the LA Olympics in 2028, which seems to me a very, very long way off. But I suppose to you preparing for it, there'll never be enough time. So I'm hoping, because there's so much else we could cover and in so much more detail, there's lots of specific things we can cover. I'm hoping you might come back in the near future and perhaps talk more in depth about the different elements of sports science and how these influence the performance of world-class athletes.
Love to.
Would you be up for that? We'll get Chris in the studio. We might even get you in the studio one day when it's not snowing and raining as it is at the minute. So before we finish, we're going to play another track chosen by you. And again, it's a great, great track. Could you tell us what the track is and why you chose it?
Well, I'm a Manchester lad originally, and James kind of the soundtrack of my youth. But then I mentioned before being on the coach traveling to games, I always have a playlist on my Spotify, and this is one that was been on this track has been on repeat. Sound by James. It's been one that I've been listening to a lot on my way to and from games.
And why is that? Is it inspirational to you, or it just gets you in the right mood, or?
Gets me in the right mood. I wouldn't say that I necessarily want anything that's going to get me too hyped up. Kind of the occasion and the moment probably does that itself. So it's just a tune that I enjoy, something I know I'm going to enjoy listening to on my way to a game.
Fantastic. Thanks once again, Tom, from all of us here at Sheffield Live.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Stay dry. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.